by the foreign minister saying that there's a limited time that this can go on like this, the way it's been going, and the Americans not really responding in any reasonable way or in any kind of effective way to the efforts that are being made by Iran to come to an agreement. If you could please first give us a little bit of that historic background of how the Majlis was involved in the JCPOA process when it was ratified by the parliament. Later on, we saw again with the law that related to the nuclear capabilities of the country, the Majlis entering the scene, telling the government that it has to defend Iran's nuclear rights, but within the JCPOA. And now, finally, we've come to this point where it seems to be that these talks are not really getting anywhere. So if you could please give us, from the perspective of the Majlis, a little insight into this issue.
خب موضوع برجام و توافق سال 2015.
Well, the issue of the JCPOA and the 2015 nuclear deal is an issue related to the previous parliament. It has been examined in the previous parliament at the time when a deal was reached between our government and the P5 plus 1 group. This agreement is in the form of a joint program. In fact, it is not an international agreement. It is not a treaty, but it is done as a joint program between the parties. But because it could create commitments for our country, the parliament got involved in it, established a special commission, held special and complex meetings for it, and finally the previous parliament approved a law. It allowed the government with 9 conditions to carry out this joint program by pursuing Iran's national interests and take its implementation steps. Of course, other conditions were added by the leader of the Islamic Republic, and they were very important conditions, and thus the JCPOA was approved by the Iranian parliament for implementation. During the implementation of the JCPOA, from the very beginning, we witnessed the other parties' breaches. They violated their own commitments, whether in the Obama era or even more so in the Trump era. This was from the American side. Finally, Trump withdrew from this agreement in 2018 and dealt a blow to the implementation of the deal. And not only did he return the previous sanctions, but during the previous period when Trump was in power, he added maybe twice as many sanctions on Iran. And apart from the fact that the U.S. government itself did not fulfill its obligations, it prevented others who were members of the agreement from implementing their obligations, and so they too started violating them. The European side entered into a dialogue with us in 2018 and announced that we can follow up on this commitment in the form of the 4+1 without America. And again, the negotiations that took place between Iran and Europe, the European side, gave us 11 commitments, which the introduction of implementing them was establishing an institution called INSTEX, which can be a financial settlement institution between Iran and Europe. But we witnessed that they delayed both in implementing this structure, and ultimately it was inefficient until they announced in recent days that they will dissolve this institution. And consequently, the 11 commitments which the Europeans gave were not implemented either. Concurrently, we witnessed the change of the parliament in Iran. The 11th parliament came, and it had a different political view than the previous one. And at the beginning of its work, due to the sensitivity of the nuclear issue, this parliament introduced a roadmap in the form of a law, and that law is a well-known law called the Strategic Action Plan to Lift Sanctions. The parliament designed a path and announced its demand to the government that the government should move in that direction. The key point was that the parliament announced in this framework that since the other party has not fulfilled its commitments, Iran should also stop the voluntary implementation of its commitments. Part of it was that we removed restrictions on the enrichment process and the enriched uranium stockpile in the parliament's law. Likewise, we said in a few months that if the other side does not take a step to lift the sanctions, Iran should no longer accept extra safeguard inspections, and the government institutions are not allowed to implement them. In fact, according to this law, the parliament took back part of the permits the previous parliament had given to the government to fulfill its obligations. And accordingly, surveillance beyond safeguards is against the law in Iran, and this is being followed up by our government. At the same time, the parliament followed the government to discuss the nuclear negotiations in order to pursue the rights of the Iranian people. We had unilaterally fulfilled our obligations based on 15 reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency. But it was the other side that had violated these commitments. And today, after a long period of time, the Parliament came to the conclusion that it should not accept a commitment unilaterally, and this is of no use. And this strategic action plan is still our roadmap in the 11th legislature. And that is why, during the nuclear negotiations that took place in Vienna, or whatever stage it reaches, the parliament invites the negotiating team or the foreign minister, hears the report of that meeting, and gives its opinion. That is, it follows up in the National Security Commission. Or regarding the cooperation between Iran and the agency on the surveillance issue, we have this meeting with the head of the Atomic Energy Organization and his deputies, and we will talk about what agreements they have made. We hear the details of it. We listen to their expert opinions. And at the same time, we follow up on its compliance with our own laws and the opinions of the parliament. Currently, the negotiation process is moving slowly. Since September, the other side has been slowing down the process of negotiations due to its own internal elections. And after what may have been a miscalculation regarding Iran's internal developments, it cannot reach a conclusion. The text of the agreement is almost ready, according to the reports we have received. It is a joint decision by the Joint Commission of Iran and 4+1, based on which the U.S. can become a member of the P5+1 group again by fulfilling certain conditions. Currently, this agreement exists between Iran and the 4+1 group. And Iran's compensatory measures are based on this agreement, paragraph 26 of the JCPOA. But we took compensatory measures because the other party fulfilled its obligations. The original agreement is available, and it is the American side that, with the change of government, even though they confirm the policy of maximum pressure failed, they will return to the agreement. Well, the Americans cannot return to the agreement without fulfilling their obligations, and this is the subject of negotiations for the past 1.5 years. The Americans resisted every step to lift any sanctions, and this has caused the negotiations to be prolonged. Otherwise, the Islamic Republic's position was the same in the beginning, and it's still the same, that if the Americans accept all their commitments, after we verify the sanctions have been lifted, Iran will return its compensatory measures to the level within the limits of the JCPOA. This is the negotiation process. But the other party has made political mistakes in the negotiating process. For instance, they kept waiting due to the elections and internal developments. Your audience knows that the internal situation is like in America, the extreme bipolarity that exists there, and they turn every issue into a political issue. This is not our concern as the opposing country, but it is the other side that has to solve its internal issues behind the door of the negotiating room, and after that, enter the negotiations. We face the obligations of the U.S. government, not the Democrats or the Republicans. But beyond this, it was an internal discussion, and perhaps they were facing a miscalculation with regard to Iran's internal developments. After September, there were protests in Iran after the death of Mrs. Amini, and the anti-Iranian groups must have tried to turn these protests into chaos and create disorder and disturbance in public security. Perhaps the Americans came to the analysis that Iran may desist from its main positions in the nuclear issue due to its own internal issues. But this was an incorrect calculation. We announced to the other party during those developments through the exchange of non-papers that we will not give up on our positions. These developments are the developments that the people themselves quickly helped to return public security to the country, and that happened. This year, we had one of the most glorious rallies on the 22nd of Bahman, the anniversary of the revolution, by the people, which was a clear international message that sovereignty in Iran, public security and public order has the maximum support in Iran. At the same time, this slowness still exists on the other side, but Iran has not stopped on the issue of nuclear negotiations. With our president's trip to China, we have the suggestion of enhancing cooperation with China on the agenda. Finding new business partners is one of our priorities, while we demand the lifting of sanctions against our country. The issue of sanctions is not an issue that will stop Iran. The parliament also requests reports from the authorities of our government at any level during the process of nuclear negotiations. It listens to their opinions, and if it has any opinion, it implements it. And in this framework, our main agenda is the strategic action plan to lift sanctions.
Doctor, we had this very, how should I call it, this kind of strategic surprise for a lot of people in the world, the agreement that happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia, contrary to the belief of many that this could never happen or that these two are never capable of coming to some sort of an agreement, of course, with the help of the Chinese government. Of course, this was done on the part of the National Security Council and Dr. Shamkhani, who did that, which is a little bit different than if the foreign ministry had done that. Of course, the foreign ministry and other organizations, security organizations, were involved in these discussions. But just in terms of the significance of this agreement, and also, once again, the Majlis's view and position on this agreement, if you could please give us a little insight and analysis, your analysis of how you see this agreement that has now happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
The parliament and the people's representatives pay a lot of attention to our relations with our neighbors. Some of the representatives are from the cities that are located in the borders of our neighboring countries. Therefore, they receive well the issue of strengthening relations with the neighbors, which is now one of the approaches and instructions of the government. In the case of Saudi Arabia, the Islamic Republic considers Saudi Arabia as an important country in the Islamic world, and our relationship with Saudi Arabia was not cut off by Iran, but it was Saudi Arabia that severed ties following some issues about the embassy and arguments before that. From the moment that some parties mediated, the Islamic Republic had announced that we are ready to restore bilateral ties with the Saudi government. But it was the other side that had some ambiguities and wanted to present conditions or to hear some issues in this regard. The Iraqi side, Mr. Al-Kadhimi government, entered as a mediator, and five rounds of security negotiations were held in Iraq with the presence of the deputy of the Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Mr. Shamkhani's deputy, and also security negotiations were held in Muscat. And finally, with a change in the government, there was a little gap in the conclusion of these negotiations, and it was the Chinese side that followed up on this issue and tried to bring these negotiations to a conclusion. Well, we have friendly relations with China. We also welcome the principle of relations with Saudi Arabia. Of course, this does not mean that we do not have difference of opinion with Saudi Arabia. We have differences of opinion on some regional issues. But with due respect to the Saudi government, we have different opinions, but we do not consider it as a negation of bilateral relations. On the contrary, we think that we can raise these differences explicitly in bilateral relations and finally reach a common solution that is in the interest of the Islamic world. In this way, negotiations were held with the mediation and suggestion of the Chinese side at a high level. And Mr. Shamkhani, in a five-day trip, met with his Saudi counterpart in Beijing, and they reached a document, and a statement was published that the two sides will move towards meeting with the foreign ministers as the ones who will follow up on this process and revive the activities of embassies in Tehran and Riyadh within a span of 2 months. Well, the initial steps have been taken. Our foreign ministers will meet soon, and after that, it seems that delegations will be exchanged. The discussion of reopening the embassies will probably be resumed soon. We consider this an achievement for the entire Islamic world because we think that the issues related to the Muslims could be brought up amongst each other. At the same time, we think that the interests of the Muslim people should be taken into consideration everywhere. China's role in this agreement was very important. China appeared as an influential actor in the West Asian region, where the Americans think they are the decisive player, and the reflection of China's role in this agreement within America in the American think tanks was extraordinary, and many considered it as America's weakness and its inability to create stability in the West Asian region and the Persian Gulf. Thus, China followed a relatively higher role than acting in these issues. But from the perspective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we think that expanding relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia can include the general interests of the Islamic world. The different issues that exist between us, from permanent religious cooperation, such as the issue of the Hajj, which is done naturally, to the development of cooperation at the economic level and the creation of a joint cooperation in the field of oil export, OPEC and OPEC Plus, are among the interesting topics that can be pursued. People's cooperation, such as consular relations, is an important topic that should be considered for the nationals of both sides. On the part of Saudi Arabia, I think different analyses were presented by the media and prominent personalities. The Saudi government has taken steps for stability in the region with this move, and I believe that by continuing this path, we can reach the vision of a united Islamic front against the Zionists. The Zionists are the party that tries to sow the seeds of animosity in the Islamic countries in order for itself to survive, to create an opportunity in some Arab countries by creating a negative space for Iran or by harming the interests of Iran, they can put on a show. But the truth is that the Zionists are not accepted among the people of the region. Not only among the people of the region, but today they are also faced with a great internal challenge, which requires a plan to return them to the source of this oppression. That is, the occupation of a land that has original owners is the basis for the formation of this wrong existence, which ultimately has led to the formation of the Zionist regime, which we think is a false structure with weak foundations that will not last long.
Dr. Amri, we've come to the end of the program. We have maybe 1 or 2 minutes left. If there's anything else you need feel that you should mention about these issues, please go ahead. We have a few minutes.
Thank you for providing me with this opportunity. Politics in Iran has an active dynamism, which means that the parliament has serious discussions, opposes and approves, and the parliament, the government, and other forces have different opinions. Those who want to analyze and evaluate Iran must seriously consider this dynamic and the activity of different views inside Iran. At the same time, our effort in the governance of Iran is that this exchange of opinions and this exchange of views will lead to a single approach and strategy, which will ultimately be seen as Iran's foreign policy. Thank you.
Dr. Amri, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Dr. Amri? As the global order is changing, the world is entering a new era with new alliances being formed. And Iran is going to be dealing with a myriad of new opportunities and challenges. This requires the effective coordination of the different organizations tasked in Iran with conducting international relations, such as the Supreme National Security Council, the Foreign Ministry, the Security Services, and of course, the Islamic Shura Majlis, which under the Constitution supervises the activities of the executive branch and without whose ratification no treaty or agreement is deemed legal under the law. As happened after the foolish U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, when the Majlis entered the scene and passed legislation to defend Iran's nuclear technology and industry in the face of Western noncompliance, so today, The Majlis is warning the U.S. that Iran will not wait forever for the U.S. and Europe to make a decision about the ongoing sanctions relief and nuclear talks in Vienna. The Majlis is also seriously pursuing its constitutional duty as it relates to Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as well as BRICS Plus, as well as Iran's recent agreement with Saudi Arabia, and in general, all the supervisory and legislative aspects related to Iran's growing relations with its neighbors and regional and global partners. The Majlis is also finally getting serious about the de-dollarization of Iran's global trade, particularly after the dollar was used by Iran's enemies to cause economic destabilization after the failed color revolution of this year, and after repeated warnings by the leader of the Islamic Revolution to end the era of the dollar in the Iranian economy. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023. The late Mr. Talighani told me, the day when Imam Khomeini said the Shah must go, I thought, what is he talking about? Now, Mahmoud Talighani was no ordinary person. In other words, someone like the late Ayatollah Talighani, a profound fighter with all the great history that he had, was not optimistic about this. But it happened. The revolution was victorious. I shall surely prevail, I and my messengers. All the imposed war of Iraq upon Iran. You weren't around then. You didn't see it. The imposed war was a strange event. Everyone was against us. The US was against us. The Soviet Union was against us. NATO was against us. Muslim countries were against us. Our neighbor, Turkey, was against us. Everyone. But we were victorious. In such a war, where everyone was against us, we were victorious. Therefore, our experience shows us the same thing. This is what awaiting the reappearance of the Saviour is about. Awaiting the reappearance does not mean that we should just sit around, waiting and praying that God will send Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajah sharif to us. Nevertheless, praying for his reappearance is something obligatory that we must do.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We need to pray. We must want this. We need to pursue it, but that's not enough. Awaiting the reappearance means that whenever there is a problem in the things we are doing, we need to believe that the time of the reappearance that we are awaiting will come. A person needs to have this expectation. Of course, there are certain necessary conditions. We need to make an effort. Awaiting the Saviour means that when you want to eat bread, you need to go to the bakery and buy the bread first. The bread is not going to come to you if you want to sit at home and wait for it. Action needs to be taken for the reappearance to occur. These are the principles that require work. There are many such principles, or there is the principle of monotheism. A sovereign other than God is forbidden. Monotheism means the negation of the sovereignty of other than God. And there are numerous other similar examples. Your associations particularly need to work on these principles. And don't focus on a small, limited point. Widen your perspective. Look at all the issues.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States and yet another example of racial discrimination. A video circulating on social media has showed a former U.S. Marine killing a mentally ill African-American homeless man by putting him in a chokehold on the New York City subway. The video shows a former Marine, identified as Daniel Penny, grabbing 30-year-old Jordan Neely around the neck while pinning him to the ground on a train in Manhattan. The medical examiner said Neely died from a compression of the neck. The incident happened on May the 1st. Witnesses say the African-American man was loudly complaining about being hungry and saying he was ready to die. They say the victim showed no behavior that was threatening to the subway passengers. Penny, 24, restrained him until the homeless man appeared to stop moving. Neely was taken to a hospital where he was later declared dead. Penny's lawyers say their client could not have known that his forceful actions, which were meant to subdue the mentally ill man, would lead to the victim's death. Penny, who had been questioned and released by police in New York on the day of the incident, later surrendered to police and was arraigned in Manhattan Criminal Court after prosecutors lodged criminal charges against him. Two other unidentified people who were also seen restraining Neely in the footage have yet to be charged. Neely's death sparked angry protests.
Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan! Justice for Jordan!
A system that has been meant to destroy us. A system that didn't want to see Jordan Neely alive. Right. Let me be very clear. It failed no one. It did exactly what it was designed to do.
The demonstrators called Neely's death an act of lynching, likening it to the murder of George Floyd by white officers in 2020. The killing of the African-American man also drew reactions from some U.S. officials. New York City Mayor Eric Adams called the incident a tragedy that never should have happened. He pledged to do more to help people experiencing mental health crises. The latest incident of racial discrimination in the U.S. comes as brutality against black people is happening at record numbers. Just to make that evident, 21 African Americans were killed by U.S. law enforcement officers only in January 2023. That already makes the year one of the deadliest ever so far for the African American community in the U.S. That includes the tragic death of Keena Darnell Anderson, who was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident. Those are only a few recent incidents of brutality of racial discrimination against blacks. The United States has a long history of such bias against people of color. One major example was a brutal killing of a 46-year-old black man named George Floyd, who died after a white police officer pressed on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest in May 2020 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The death of the handcuffed black man triggered months of widespread protests, not only in cities across the U.S., but also other parts of the world. Those incidents come as African Americans and other ethnic minorities are often subject to harsh discrimination and racial profiling by white supremacists in the United States. One reason could be that U.S. politicians not only have failed to bring an end to racial profiling against the people of color, but at times have fanned the flames of hatred against them. That could clearly be seen when former U.S. President Donald Trump was in office. The former president numerously emboldened white supremacists with his racist remarks during his tenure. U.S. President Joe Biden, who took the helm in 2021, claimed to be a critic of racial injustice, but he also failed to eradicate racial discrimination in the country. With many arguing that America was built on slavery, it is not erroneous to claim that racial profiling against African Americans and other people of color is deeply rooted in American culture. Maybe that's why it is too early to think that putting an end to prejudice and racism in the U.S. does not seem to be happening anytime soon.
Shock and desperation. Children traumatized. Mothers losing their children. Israel claims it is not targeting civilians, but the injured and the dead tell another story. Like dead Palestinian girl carried by her father. With over 100 wounded, how many times will Israel kill civilians like women and children, yet claim it is targeting resistance fighters and leaders? When is it enough?
Are you ready to say enough is enough? As the highest authority responsible for the maintenance of international peace and security?
As of Saturday, May 13, Israel has so far assassinated 6 Islamic Jihad leaders, and it has stated it is after more blood. The killing machine has no mercy. One bombing operation involved 40 aircrafts and drones, courtesy of the United States. The incessant sound of drones creates a constant state of terror, panic, and anxiety among the 2 million people living in the Gaza Strip. Al-Mizan, a human rights group based in Gaza, notes that between the years 2000 and 2023, at least 2,148 Palestinians, including 378 children and 86 women, were killed by Israeli drones. Nearly 350 were killed inside their homes, including more than 100 children, underscoring the reality that there is no safe place in Gaza. And these are conservative figures. resistance groups in the Gaza Strip have not stood idle. Palestinian factions, like the Islamic Jihad, said they are united in their joint response. Resistance factions have been relentless in their rocket attacks. Many have reached as far as Tel Aviv, or close to it, like the town, which claimed the life of one Israeli, injuring five others. Israel getting a taste of its own medicine. As a matter of fact, the resistance group's firepower has overwhelmed Israel's so-called Iron Dome system. In one tally, more than 500 rockets were fired at Israel. Of these, 368 rockets made it over the border, and 154 were intercepted by the so-called Iron Dome missile defense system. Simple math shows that this dome had a 30% success rate. And Israel better be careful. Reports indicate it has so far only hit Islamic Jihad targets. Israel knows that Palestinian resistance groups are believed to be capable of firing thousands of rockets, which could quickly exhaust Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. On top of that, Israel is unable to sustain prolonged disruption to its civilian economy amid widespread fear and panic among its population. Israel is now at its weakest. Regionally, it is isolated more than ever. Iran and Saudi Arabia's reconciliation have solidified the axis of resistance, especially after Saudi Arabia hosted Hamas recently and is warming up to Hezbollah. And from within, Israel is unraveling due to the revolt by Israelis against the judicial reforms. Protest now in its fourth month. There's growing consensus that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu launched the assault on Gaza to appease his fractious, extreme coalition, particularly Itamar Ben-Gvir, in order to distract from the protests. Yet Netanyahu may be risking it all when the Tel Aviv skyline is filled with too many rockets that would rain down and eliminate its presence on Palestinian land. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen urged Congress to raise the $31.4 trillion debt limit and avert an unprecedented default, saying that a failure to do so would have dire consequences. Yellen's comments come after she warned of an economic catastrophe if the U.S. fails to raise its debt ceiling in the coming weeks. She has also previously warned that the U.S. could fail to meet its debt obligations sooner than expected, and it may run out of measures as early as June 1. Yellen issued the latest in a series of increasingly stark warnings in remarks prepared for a press conference meeting in Japan with her counterparts from the Group of Seven G7 rich nations, as well as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. Yellen's comments came as a political stalemate over raising the debt limit was forcing the Treasury Department dangerously close to worst-case scenario, which is a potential U.S. debt default.
The notion of defaulting on our debt is something that would so badly undermine the U.S. and global economy that I think it should be regarded by everyone as unthinkable.
In order to avoid a default on the nation's debt, Congress must vote to either raise or suspend the debt limit before the Treasury runs out of emergency funding. But with only days left this month, time is running out to reach a deal. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The last time this happened, the U.S. saw its credit rating downgraded and interest rates on its existing debt go up. Even if the nation avoids tumbling over the fiscal cliff, the U.S. economy could suffer.
They're doing the best, to the best of my knowledge, what no other political party has done in the nation's history. They're literally, not figuratively, holding the economy hostage by threatening to default on our nation's debt that we've already incurred.
The debt ceiling is the maximum amount the U.S. government is legally authorized to borrow to meet its obligations. Many investors are bracing for the economic fallout of the deadline for the U.S. to raise the debt ceiling or default on its obligations. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since the year 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues.
Congress has told Treasury, you should pay our bills, you should pay our debt. But at the same time, it's told it, you can't borrow anymore to pay those bills and debt. And at the same time, Congress has authorized all of the spending that's being done. So the spending's going out the door. The bills are showing up at Treasury, and Treasury isn't getting in enough revenue from taxpayers to pay the bills. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing over what Treasury should do.
Even short of a default, hitting the debt ceiling would stop the government's ability to finance its operations, including providing for the national defense or funding entitlements such as Medicare or Social Security. The default could cause the loss of 3 million jobs, add $130,000 to the cost of an average 30-year mortgage, and raise interest rates enough to increase the national debt by $850 billion. Meanwhile, the recent turmoil in the banking industry have concerned investors. In early May, officials closed San Francisco-based First Republic Bank, making it the third U.S. bank to collapse in the past 2 months. Most of First Republic's assets are being acquired by J.P. Morgan, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, whose clients were mostly from the tech industry, collapsed in March under similar circumstances. But they are not alone. The U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that 722 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Those losses have occurred because banks bought lots of treasuries and bonds when interest rates were near zero. Now, as the Federal Reserve raises rates to combat inflation, the value of these bonds has declined.
Israel has kept pounding the Gaza Strip, targeting areas in the southern part of the besieged Palestinian territory. It came after the Israeli military conducted airstrikes against the Gaza Strip, assassinating senior Islamic Jihad officials.
The Israeli occupation committed a great crime and treacherous aggression against our people in the Gaza Strip by bombing residential areas and homes, which led to the killing of children and women and targeted the leaders of the resistance. Our people and the resistance know how to respond to this great crime and make the occupation pay the price for this aggression on the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza have fired rockets towards Israeli sites in retaliation for the regime's deadly air raids, hitting targets as far as Tel Aviv. Gaza's Joint Command of Palestinian Resistance Groups claimed responsibility for firing rockets at Israel, saying in a statement it had fired hundreds of rockets towards the occupied Palestinian territories, including Tel Aviv, in an operation codenamed Revenge of the Free. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has warned that Israel will pay the price for the killings. The Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den has warned the Tel Aviv regime of surprise and unprecedented retaliatory attacks after the assassination of high-profile resistance commanders in Israeli airstrikes. Iran, Lebanon, Egypt, Jordan, amongst many Muslim countries, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, condemned in separate statements the Israeli aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip. High-profile commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement have been assassinated after Israeli military aircraft launched a series of targeted strikes on the Gaza Strip days after a fiery flare-up of violence set the besieged coastal area on edge. Alongside the assassinations, military compounds and a military position belonging to the Islamic Jihad were targeted as well. The Islamic Jihad resistance commanders in the strikes include Khalil Bahitini, the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the northern Gaza Strip, Tariq Izzeddin, a spokesperson for the movement, and Jihad Al-Ghannam, secretary of the movement's military council. Bahitini was the most senior operational commander in the Islamic Jihad and was responsible for the rocket fire towards occupied territories in the past month. Izzeddin was responsible for the communications between the movement and its branches in the West Bank and for transferring funds and coordinating resistance active in the occupied lands. Ghannam was one of the most senior and veteran operatives in Islamic Jihad and served at one point as the commander of the Al-Quds Brigades in the southern Gaza Strip.
This enemy is a criminal entity ever since it was created on the land of Palestine. It assassinated leaders in their homes with their families and children. They did not assassinate them in the battlefield, not in the streets or cars. They assassinated them while they were with their children and killed their children and women along with them.
Meanwhile, Israeli troops have shot dead two young Palestinian men during a military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Kabatia, the latest in a year-long spike of violence that shows no sign of abating. The Israeli military said it conducted a raid in the early hours of Wednesday on Kabatia, situated 6 kilometers south of Jenin. The Palestinian Ministry of Health identified the victims as 19-year-old Ahmed Jamal Asif and 24-year-old Warani Walid Katanat. Another Palestinian was injured in the assault. Witnesses said a large number of Israeli forces raided Kabatia and broke into several homes in the western neighborhood of the West Bank city. They violently searched the buildings and ransacked all properties before leaving. The Israeli forces then closed the main streets in the town while laying siege to a number of houses. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank so far this year.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we said that the Islamic Revolution and its unmatched leader, Imam Khomeini, drew the attention of the world thinkers from the very beginning. For a couple of episodes, we have dwelt upon the views of the French thinker, Michel Foucault, on Imam Khomeini. Today, we will continue the discussion. Michel Foucault believed that not only religion is not the opium of masses, but also it is the spirit of the spiritless world. In view of this, he maintained that religion is the engine which unites various classes in society and brings their forces together towards a common goal. Today we are going to explain Foucault's opinion on the concept of power in the Islamic Revolution. Stay with us, please. French thinker Michel Foucault is of the opinion that power is not limited to a specific group, class, or person. He believes that power has a network structure, which is spread in the whole society like the nervous system. Power is a kind of software and is not necessarily wielded through violent means. Thus, a speech, a book, a tape, a piece of voice or video in the modern form of the medium can be a source of power. The French thinker says that power has been spread in every individual, and if they get united, they will make a power which cannot be confronted with any army or power. He analyzes the Iranian people's confrontation with the armed-to-the-teeth royal army in this framework. Foucault explains why the Shah regime failed to resist against the people despite the high military and economic power. He says that although the Shah's army possessed the most advanced weapons and equipment in the region and enjoyed the consultation of over 40,000 American advisors, it was defeated by the people who sacrificed all they had in the way of their leader. As for the economic power too, the regime enjoyed exorbitant oil revenues which would fill the coffers of the royal family. Foucault maintains that the Iranian society was not that poor to cause the people to topple the ruling system. Of course, this is not true, and poverty can be considered one of the factors for the nationwide uprising of the Iranian people. Michel Foucault fails to understand the depth of the Iranian people's belief in and love of their religious leaders, especially the bravest and most uncompromising of them, Imam Khomeini. Moreover, he has not realized the fact that, except the top brass, the main fiber of the army was formed of popular forces and officers who defied the commands of their top commanders in shooting and killing their compatriots and Muslim brothers. French thinker Michel Foucault relates what he had seen in one of the suburbs of Tehran during the Islamic Revolution. In a very unsafe place around Tehran, my friends made the preparations for my visit with a few top officers who were among the opponents of the Shah's regime. They told me that the more violent the unrest becomes, the regime would be forced to resort to the military units that are neither ready for the job nor have they the motive for it. Moreover, they would understand that they are not facing the international communism, but the ordinary people, the businessmen, employees, or jobless people who are like their brothers or themselves. These people can be forced to shoot only once, but not the second time. 8 months ago, they were forced in Tabriz to change the garrisons. In Tehran too, although some units have come from other provinces, they were forced to change them. Foucault makes it clear that he has heard that some of the military forces had targeted their commanders or committed suicide the day after shooting the ordinary people. Michel Foucault continues on the Islamic Revolution. What astonished me in Iran is that there is no battle among different elements. What makes all these beautiful and important is that there is only a single confrontation. The confrontation of all people with the power, which threatens the people with weapons and police. No need to go very far. This point can be understood instantly. On one side, there is the entire will of the people, and on the other side, there are the machine guns. Foucault compares the Islamic Revolution of Iran with other revolutions and says, Iran's events, in fact, are not found in China, or in Vietnam, or in Cuba. It is a huge wave without a military tool, without a party in the front. It is the first paradoxical phenomenon, and the reason for the hastiness of these events is that people have struggled for 10 months against a regime which is one of the most armed regimes in the world, and that with bare hands, without resorting to armed struggle. They have petrified the army bravely and decisively. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Amid contradictory reports on the contents of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad in the besieged Gaza Strip and Israel, Palestinian experts say that the Israeli regime is to abide by the agreement, at least for the time being, but they add that it's unclear how long the latest ceasefire will hold before the regime breaches it. Israel's seriousness will be determined to some extent by the length of the period of calm, they say.
Whether the Israelis are going to commit to this ceasefire, as we know that this is not the first time we have truce or ceasefire. It happened hundreds of times before, and all the time it was Israel who broke this kind of agreement, not just because the Palestinians do anything, but because the Israeli themselves and in this kind of regime, the colonial racist regime, it's used to that.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during a cabinet meeting on Sunday, told his ministers that the Israeli military took out the entire leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and by doing so fulfilled the goals of the so-called Shield and Arrow operation in perfect form. He also claimed that Tel Aviv had changed the equation and thwarted the entire top of the jihad movement. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has demanded that targeted killing be carried out against Palestinian resistance leaders in the West Bank as well. He added that the last operation was good and important, but it must be continued.
The most important thing is that the Israeli regime failed to achieve any political goal, failed in restoring deterrence, failed in oppressing the resistance or creating a fraction between the Palestinians themselves or between different factions. Netanyahu has maybe temporarily succeeded in regaining his popularity. However, he will face his problems within days. This round is failure to Israel.
Analysts, meanwhile, say one of the reasons Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire is Thursday's controversial flag march that is held every year by the Israelis to mark the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967 Six-Day War. This annual event has prompted fightings in past years as the Israeli regime insisted not to reroute the flag march away from the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds. Palestinians wonder whether the Israeli policies and killings in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds would affect in a way or another the inevitability of the ceasefire, mainly after Ben-Gvir's call to assassinate resistance leaders in the West Bank. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
From the disgrace of the Nakba to today's resistance,
The 75th anniversary of the occupation of Palestine is a time to reflect on the long way the oppressed nation of Palestine has come in its struggle for freedom, while shedding light on the numerous instances of human rights violations committed by Israel in the Palestinian territories.
There are over 1,000 Palestinians currently jailed in administrative detention with no charge or no trial under a Zionist regime that can indefinitely extend their detention, leaving them jailed with no charge or no trial for years on end.
The issue of Palestine is the most important issue in the Muslim world, and Nakba is an occasion for all of us to condemn the atrocities against Palestinians